This interview before I start is brought to you by CD Natural Stone, who've managed to fund the series of Chelsea interviews that I'm doing. And so if you get a minute, just search them on the Twitter or the Facebook and give them a random high five. I should probably press play on the intro tune. One second.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sod Show Garden Podcast.
My company today is?
I'm Gabby, and I'm a co-designer with River of Flowers and Urban Bees. They're in partnership to try and raise awareness of how important it is to have forage for bees and pollinators in urban places.
I get the bees and the pollinators bit. I think we all get that. Strikes two different images in my head. Maybe not in my head, but in my head on behalf of some other person's head, if that makes sense.
Well, bees are foragers. They go round to different flowers and they collect their pollen, and they then in turn pollinate the flowers and the plants. And the solitary bees are really important for pollinating a lot of our fruit and vegetables. And if we don't provide enough food for them in urban areas, then they'll just die out.
Is it a case of that you're not saying, listen, Peter, if you live in a rural farmland area, you're not what we're aiming at? We're aiming for those that are maybe living in London, who've concreted in the front garden space, and they have a plastic hedge to cover the bin and two pot plants inside that are cactus that don't flower, are possibly going to end up in a bin, yet they're our target market. Have I got this bang on?
Yeah, exactly. Like, we've obviously a lot of our display is the wildflower mix that we have here. Uh-huh. And so we want to show that the wildflower is obviously very beautiful. And because a lot of people feel quite compelled just to say, oh, it's just a weed. So what we're trying to show that's also very beautiful and important. So aesthetically and also for ecology as well.
So give me a list of what you are suggesting people plant. So the plants person in my head has a notion of where we're headed.
So we have a bespoke mix, which is done for us here. I think we've got about
30
different flowering plants in the wildflower mix. And they come out at different times during the spring and summer. And we also have the vertical, the living wall, which we've arranged to provide pollinators with food throughout the year. So, for example, a lot of the flowering plants, like the bugle, is flowering now, but ivy comes out in September and October, and that will be providing food when there aren't that many flowers around.
If I'm your stereotypical target, I say market, not for marketing speak jargon type thing, but if I'm the person that you're, not me, obviously, but I'm the fictitious person that you want to aim at, which has got concrete everything. I've got a concrete fetish. If I don't see more concrete, I'm going to get slightly irate and upset. Are you suggesting that another or that person essentially eliminates the concrete in the front driveway, all of it, which we know isn't going to happen? Or are you saying, no, Peter, we'll take the whole lot if it's going, but we'll also take a little. Here's the little steps that you can take, and let me throw one into the mix because I haven't read anything on you. And that's not because I'm lazy in this department. It's just because I want to learn as the listener learns. Does any of this apply to people who live on apartment balconies?
We're not particularly aiming at individuals. We do a lot of work where we try to identify gaps in urban areas where there aren't enough wildflowers and there aren't enough pollinator-friendly plants. And we try to link these spaces with new wildflower areas so that there aren't big gaps for bees to fly across or try to find food. They can find food in lots of spaces in the city.
And this is why we actually have the modular system here, which are these modular planters that can fit together. So you can actually create a larger space if you have it, or a smaller space if you have it, to plant a wildflower seed.
I'm going to ask this as naively as I can, but is there a product that you actually sell?
So far, we've only really supplied to businesses, large businesses and organisations and charities. So we've had our planters put in public spaces, and River of Flowers never sell a planter without the plants. So we plant them before they're sold so that we can make sure that they have plants in that are beneficial to bees. So they're not an off-the-shelf product that we sell empty. We sell them as meadows.
I should probably have asked you at the start, what do you do for a living? And this would have been a really easy job.
We are both landscape architects, and we are working in partnership with River Flowers and Urban Bees. But I'm also a director of River Flowers with Catherine, the founding director. There's a partnership between designers and horticultural thinking and bee knowledge.
Now, I'm slightly glad I didn't ask you what you do for a living. This isn't your living then.
We both work in landscape architecture and garden design, but we're doing this because we care about bees, basically, and ecology is an important part of what we do as landscape architects. So
this reminds me a little bit of my good friend Ben Brace when he was a landscape architect, and he was a tree warden, and I asked him like why he did it, and there was no, it's a bit like why does Peter do the side show, there's no monetary gain, because I couldn't get my head around why you took a stand or a stall or a space at Chelsea to give up your time to build that, to do when you've got a full-time job. I'm going to ask you something that a lot of people ask me about doing the things that I do in my spare time that are not for money. Apart from the feel-good factor, there's nothing really that I gain from doing the sod show. People tell me, oh, it's popular, or you could come in here and you could promote your podcast. And I go, what's the point in promoting the podcast? I'm not going to earn any more money from it if I promote it. Are we on a par, in a sense, except yours is bees and mine is retelling your story about the bees?
I'd say that's a fair comparison, absolutely. But we also just really love horticulture and the industry in general, and it's really great to be here and see everybody putting in so much effort and enjoying everything about horticulture and landscape. It's really, really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Yeah.
For the mom at home who's got a daughter who's 5 and, let's say, 7, and they're living in a tiny, or they've got an apartment-sized front garden, if you understand me, whether it's an apartment or a inverted commas house, what do they do next?
If they live in a very small space, they could try using a planter and planting some flowering climbers. If they have a sunny wall, then things like clematis. And if they're in a shady spot, ivy is also really good for pollinators. So you can grow up, you can grow around things. You don't have to plant in the ground.
If your entire garden is concreted in, you inherited it. You've got to get the kitchen done first, logically, because that's what happens with landscaping budgets. But you want to make a little bit of difference. You've heard this. You've gone to the website. We'll get all those details in a minute. But you've got a friend who's got a Kango hammer or a pickaxe or a sledgehammer, and you're willing to break out one little bit, get a handful of compost and drop it in because you don't want to buy a planter because you're stuck for the money because the kitchen handles have to go on the counters, etc. What do you put into that small, tiny pocket?
Well, actually, that's quite a good situation because actually wildflowers like poor quality soil. So actually broken up concrete is kind of the best condition for them. Wildflowers grow really well in brownfield and actually in situations like that. So I'd just say just scatter a seed mix down straight on it, on the broken up concrete, and it will flourish.
Our trio planters with the wildflower meadow in, they don't have any soil in. They've got a substrate made up of crushed brick and stone, and it's a lightweight one as well, so you can have it on roof gardens and things like that. And there's actually very little organic material in there because they don't need a lot of fertility in the soil.
What's the biggest project River of Flowers has done?
We do lots of little projects and we work with lots of different organisations. We've worked with Fairmont Hotels and Savoy. And we do lots of small things. We've done temporary things. We've worked with Lambeth Council to create a nicer housing estate by planting with the community, and we've also helped to educate people about how to plant for pollinators. So it's partly about planting, but it's also about interacting with people, getting people who grow plants and who are interested in plants to link up so that there's a stronger network of organisations who all have a common aim, which is to help bees and pollinators.
How do they go about giving you money, and what do they get in return for that? I know they get a planter with some wildflowers, inverted commas, in it. That's on a very simple level.
Well, people can contact River of...
That's all right. These things happen.
River of Flowers can be contacted through their website, riveroflowers.org.uk. If somebody is interested in commissioning wildflower meadow planters, but also donations go towards small projects like educational planting days, things like that. Whenever money comes in, we distribute it between lots of important things.
What's important?
Raising awareness of the importance of feeding bees, and there are lots of factors that are adding to the decline of bees. For example, pesticides, pollution, chemical fertilizers, things like that. And it's just about getting people to be a bit more aware of how important they are. A lot of our food produce is pollinated by bees, especially solitary bees. And if they weren't there, we wouldn't have half of the food that we have in the supermarkets. So they're not only important, well, they're really important for humans.
Guy jested earlier on about the guy who turns around and says to his girlfriend, I think bees are smelly, or I think bees are horrible, or whatever that conversation is. There's nobody in their right mind would stand up on live television today and say bees are bad or I don't like them, if you understand me. What is fashionable to be said, as a guy who studied horticulture and brackets, etc., and likes hugging trees and used to grow plants under his bed, you know the drill at this stage of the game. But what is fashionable to say is that there should be a ban on pesticides, or there should be a ban on neonicotinoids. When I horticulturally ask some, not all, just some, why did you want Arsene Wenger out? Why did you think that EastEnders is your favourite soap? What essentially is a neonicotinoid? What is a pesticide? And how does that affect the bee count? Some would struggle to give me an answer on that, but yet they'll still put their hand up and say, can you explain to those who maybe aren't aware, who don't know the technical answer, if I'm allowed to call it that?
Well, chemicals like glyphosate, they are actually poisonous to bees and humans, and they're being used on a lot of our crops. Glyphosate's being slowly banned in various countries around Europe, and hopefully it will be banned here too.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, people should really avoid using it at home, because when they use it at home as well, like if they are using it on weeds, it washes into obviously the drains as well, and then it goes into the system, so then it's a poison, so people should really avoid using it, both for public safety and also for wildlife.
I'm going to ask you a slightly silly question then, because we've got what you would describe as glyphosate, essentially a weed killer, and you've got a pesticide. So one is, as I would have had to or did use when I was maintaining the roses in the War Memorial Park in Dublin. They were sprayed every 7 to 14 days with a fungicide and with a pesticide. That's not a weed killer. A glyphosate is a weed killer. So I get that one might kill the flowering plants in my lawn if I use I'm going to get technical, big worded here now, folks, a semi-selective one. Won't kill the grass, but will kill the broadleaf. The other one only kills the insects that I don't want to harm my roses. I don't mean to put a top of the pops pole up there, but if I said to you, you've got to have one band, or which is worse, if you understand me, for those who are trying to do a little.
I think it's difficult generally interfering with, I mean, we all know that it's, if you start interfering with nature and its balance, you're going to get sort of a huge amount of predators, say if you're, say, spraying for blackfly. So whatever you do in the garden, there are other natural alternatives that, so ecology does balance itself out.
It does, but then prize roses are prize roses, and in order to keep them squeaky clean, for the greater, or at least as and how I was reared and looking after them, they do require spraying. And I'm not playing devil's advocate with you here. It's more a case of, if you've got a collection of prize roses that are worth a bazillion pounds, my photosynthetic loving brain can appreciate why somebody would want to spray to keep them perfect. However, there's also the bit where there's a little bit of logic kicks in and says, but I appreciate why you wouldn't want them to use that. But we're semi back to the concrete thing of, well, if I can't get you to break out the whole thing, how about you just break out a little piece? Is that a...
be a sort of a level of compromise and awareness. And I think a lot of horticulturalists actually do really respect wildlife because they understand that it's an integral part of what they do. So I think, you know, there is a bit of a compromise. Yes, maybe perhaps you would use a fungicide, but perhaps you would actually maybe, you know, plant a sort of semi-cultivated wild meadow mix. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there has to be a bit of a balance as well in reality. I know, you know, for example, people might not leaf cutter bees because obviously they will eat the leaves off maybe some of their prized plants. But we all know that we need to protect those bees, and that's the important thing. So
you can tell me on the record or off the record, you can tell me when to cut this and this doesn't have to go there. I don't mind that. But have you had the conversations that we've had just now with people who said, look, I've got this thing that I do need to spray. It's a rose, it's a whatever the case may be. And they're trying to do the weigh and scales things in their head. I'm going to give you a bad analogy, my apologies here. To get somebody who's got a let's call it a 50-acre estate where they've got a rose garden and they've got a dak garden and that type of garden all contained in the one grounds, it's like trying to get somebody to go vegan, isn't it? And unless a ban comes in, a carpet ban, where they turn around and go, outright, that's it, all alcohol sales in Ireland are stopped, nobody's allowed to drink Guinness anymore. But if you understand me, unless that comes in, it's never going to entirely change.
I think so, but I think, you know, things are changing actually, and I think there are now sort of in gardening people that actually do use a much more sort of holistic method. I personally only use my hands obviously to weed, and I think a lot of gardeners do that now. So I think things are changing. People are becoming much more aware about chemicals that are used in these different sprays. So, and there has been a talk about it in the media as well. So I think people are starting to sort of think twice before spraying.
There was a garden that I designed about a year ago. And when I came in and looked at the garden first, it looked like something out of a Dallas or one of those old TV programs where the houses were big, huge, everything was white and they'd rounded columns going up outside the front and you had a big long driveway with horses in the front. You know what I'm talking about. That's what the garden reminded me of. And I was half saying in my head when I first walked in, where do you play if you've got children? Fall over. Everything was just sparkling white porcelain. The request was to undo it. The lady had mentioned biodiversity, and I'm looking at this this showroom is probably a better description. Where are you getting these words from? You couldn't have biodiversity and permaculture and all of these fancy damn names here if you tried. But we got talking and she said essentially her daughter had come home and said, Mom, there's nowhere for it. It's going to go past in a sec. We give it a minute.
It's still a working site today.
Yeah.
They're still semi-building.
It'll be fine. But she was explaining to me that her 7-year-old daughter came home and said, Mom, our garden isn't right. We don't have anywhere for the bees to go, and we don't have anywhere for them to eat anything in winter time. And She'd heard, funnily enough, there's something going on everywhere, but she'd heard, funnily enough, the interview that I did with Anna Platoni, who is the entomologist with the Royal Horticultural Society. I think it was 2016, and the butterfly dome that they'd created. And Anna was talking about leaving oranges upside down and putting a little bit of water in it, and she got talking about buddleias, and I was saying, look, you can't put buddleias into your garden. They take down chimney stacks in London. But I get the point that she was taking, and it was like somebody had just turned around and they'd seen Hendrix on stage when all they'd ever heard beforehand was S Club 7 and Steps and Shania Twain, and you're going, oh my God, the Blues Brothers, she's watched the movie, she now knows who Aretha Franklin is, something exists up there in the great big whatever you believe in. And I thought it was absolutely wonderful. There's a girl with a microphone there. I'm here with a microphone. She's got headphones on. She just looks more important than me. As a guy who makes gardens for a living, do you two get to do that? Because you're essentially on par with me, but in this case I've got the microphone and I'm asking questions. Does that make sense? Have you got them? Is that part of the change that you were talking about just there?
Yeah, I think sort of trends in design seem to be going much more less formal, actually, and people are actually becoming really interested in diversity. And I think there's a few things going on, you know, like we all understand that, like, you know, monoculture isn't good, and we recognise things like permaculture. And I think people are interested in kind of trying out those things at home. And I think it looks like it's going in a really sort of positive direction, I would say. Even here at Chelsea, some of the show gardens are actually quite experimental. They're not as perhaps formal as they might have been 10 years ago. And there's some really interesting plants and real diversity. People are really looking at using, you know, interesting combinations together, where the association is perhaps quite an unusual setting, or inspired by something unusual that they've seen in the landscape. I mean, as like, we're both obviously landscape architects, so we're really inspired by landscape space and the natural world. So seeing garden design kind of really taking a lot of inspiration from that at Chelsea is really exciting.
I'm going to ask you a question, and you can say, Peter, I plead the Fifth Amendment, or some variation of. I drove into the car park of a super duper store. It's got a flat list of about 7 plants. Viburnum Davidii, Berberis something or other, Tunbergii, it doesn't really matter, they're not fussed. Ligustrum, I could say Ovalifolium aurea variegata, but it's not that, it's just stick it in there, that's fine, and probably Lonicera nitida, maybe one or two others if they just happen to be on the back of the truck. Apologies for the long name, folks, for those who aren't following. Essentially, it's just a supermarket car park range of planting. Do you see that and go, oh my God, someone's just scratched their nails on the blackboard. Someone give me a lemon tree. I want to put jam on their toast or beans on their breakfast.
I don't always think that, because there is a reason for using these tough, reliable plants, and it's where there is no maintenance available.
They grow.
A living plant is better than soil that has nothing in at all, that's been, you know, just left. So I think there is a place for everything.
That's a very logic, diplomatic answer, and I applaud you on that. And I do get your point. I appreciate why supermarket car parks, for example, apologies if you own a supermarket and you're listening to this, I don't mean to upset your morning, but I get why they're planted between October so they don't have to water them. I get that. But still in my heart, my head wants to say, come on, let's do the rooftop garden. Let's go and get River of Flowers in. Let's deck the whole place with bells of holly. We'll put on the Cliff Richard album and the Cliff Richard jumpers. It'll be fantastic. You'll feel good. Your wife will fall in love with you all over again, or whoever you don't know you fancy, and it'll be great. It's all out of my system now. If I was to give you a golden wand in the morning, and again, let me go back to it now, we're on the same page, and apologies for my wry wit of a horticultural nature, I should add, but if I was to give you a golden wand in the morning, and you've got a 6-year-old daughter, and you've got to get her one plant, she's allowed to put it in the front garden or the back garden or on the window ledge or on the balcony, £2, £3, £5 max, what are you going to give her?
Hmm. That's a tough question. I don't have a daughter.
I'll give you a random one. I spoke to a friend of mine and he told me after the height of the recession, he went out and he dug 3 daisies up out of the local park and he put them into a pot that he found. A tiny, I mean, like the, you know, size of your fist. Potted it up and he gave it to his daughter for a birthday present, which I thought was lovely. And when they went out of flower, he knows nothing about plants. In fact, he's probably the... That's what surprised me most about the story, was not that he was obviously romantic and a little bit of Jerry Maguire and all of that stuff in there. Have you got one of them?
I mean, like a good tough plant? Like, is that what you're saying? That he just picked something and gave it to his daughter? I mean,
put it back to Gabby. He had no money, so he had to give her something, number one. What I'm saying is, for those listening at home who've got a really small space, want to put a plant outside that they can go and buy in a garden centre or somewhere like that, or from you, even better.
I mean, I tell you what, like erigerons are fantastic because they're really, really low maintenance and they just flower all summer. They're fantastic and they're actually drought tolerant. So I really think that's a good, easy plant to start with. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about what...
Hold on, he's doing it again. Yeah, you're all right, don't worry.
What would provide a treat to a child and also be beneficial? I would say a ribes shrub, because it would provide red currants, which are lovely, and also flowers in the spring.
Ribes, that's R-I-B-E-S. I think the one I remember is Ribes sanguineum. That's a long name. Just go in at your local garden centre for ribes, R-I-B-E-S. They're actually pretty cool and I like them a lot, actually. For those of you listening at home, if you're stuck for any of the details of River of Flowers, at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/TheSideshow, sideshow.com.
We haven't yet thanked our lovely sponsors at CED for providing our white limestone, which is not only on our...
Don't thank them just yet.
..on our floor, but we've also used it in the bee drinking pool. So we soaked it in water and bees can stand on the stones and then access water because bees need to drink as well as eat.
They're still building the show, so yeah, that's what this is all about.
Yeah. I'll just wait. Do your outro again.
Okay.
You can do it now, hopefully. Hello. Okay, go now.
We'd just like to thank Fat Leaf, our main contractor, for creating all of these lovely planters out of larch, and CED Stone for providing us with white limestone aggregate for our floor. And we also created a bee drinking pool using the white limestone, which is soaked in water, and then bees can access water for drinking because they need drinking as well as eating.
Now we've got one for those listening at home. I saw somebody doing this with a spoon for a bee that had been hibernating. Have I got this right? A drop of sugar into it. And you see it's mad, isn't it? You see the bee sucking the sugary water up. It's like putting them on a drip back into action for the year. Explain to me a bit about the CED stone. Not for CED stone's sake, because they deserve it, fair play. But also because of what it is that you've done.
Well, a bee drinking pool is something that's really easy to make. Anyone can make it. You can use a dish or a plant pot tray, fill it with pebbles, and then just make sure it's got water in it.
But not too much above the stone level, I gather. So
yeah, there has to be some stone sticking out of the water. The bees sit on the stones and drink the water.
If you go to the photograph, by the way, for sideshow.com, you see Kerry and Gabby. They've got I don't know, what do you call it? It looks like I've brought you to Woodstock. But they're pretty cool. Ivy crowns. Gabby, Kerry, thank you so much for your time. Real pleasure.
You're welcome. Absolutely welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been lovely talking to you.